Too big to fail, you know. Yeah, what about its lesser known but no less crucial cousin, though? Systemically important financial institutions. Try that one on for size, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you along, everybody. It's the last day of March 2016. It's a Thursday. And you know, I could go out onto 3rd Avenue, right outside Marketplace East headquarters where I am today. I could stop 10 people, ask them what they remember about the financial crisis, and I'd bet 6 of them, probably more like 7 or 8, would say something about too big to fail. The idea that there were banks and other companies in this economy that simply had to be bailed out or the whole thing would have gone down the drain. Like, really? Down the drain. The Dodd-Frank law put in something of a fix for that. It said that companies that were too big would be designated as systemically important financial institutions and would have to live under special rules meant to protect the rest of us should they go under. All of which is a very long windup to the news of the day. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. ruled yesterday afternoon that MetLife, the insurance company, should not be considered systemically important. The judge said regulators hadn't accurately figured out how vulnerable MetLife might be to some kind of financial crisis, although the ruling was partly under seal, so there's possibly more on that one. Anyway, as if on cue, today General Electric, parent of GE Capital, asked regulators to lift its SIFI designation. Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us started with a little bit of MetLife-GE compare and contrast.
MetLife says it's, you know, just an insurance company. It's argued for years that it's different from a bank like, say, Goldman Sachs because
they tend to have more capital, which means they are somewhat less leveraged.
That's Lawrence J. White. He teaches economics at NYU's Stern School of Business. But MetLife is a financial institution. He says we shouldn't forget it manages about $500 billion in assets. That's its business. AIG was also an insurance company, and its demise in 2008 led to, well, you know that story. This ruling could get rid of that too-big-to-fail distinction for MetLife, which means it wouldn't have to deal with the Federal Reserve anymore. And maybe more important, it wouldn't have to keep as much capital on hand. But
if they got into trouble, the consequences for the rest of the economy could be substantial.
Then there's GE. An industrial company whose lending arm, GE Capital, ballooned to an enormous size over the years. After the financial crisis, GE decided to get back to manufacturing, and GE Capital has dumped more than half of its investments. That's still more than $250 billion, but at least it's making an effort, right? James Kwok is a professor at the University of Connecticut Law School.
I mean, in a sense, you could say GE, this is a success story for the entire regulatory regime, right? So the regulator said you are systemically important. GE didn't want to be, and they took steps to get rid of that.
So what does MetLife's win in court mean for Dodd-Frank and the future of financial regulation? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more on that.
Maybe it's best to start with what doesn't happen now.
It's not a loophole. It's not been a decision made whether they can or can't regulate an insurance company the size of Metropolitan. It's none of that.
James Cox is a professor of corporate and securities law at Duke University.
It's just merely saying that this one attempt was not sufficient, but that doesn't prevent them from making future attempts.
He says it's possible the government will appeal this decision, but going forward, they'll likely have to change how they determine whether companies are systemically important. Donald Lampson is a lawyer at Squire Patton Boggs. He helped draft the Dodd-Frank legislation when he worked in government, and he says the designation process isn't very transparent.
There's a black box they use, but no one knows precisely what is in that black box. And at the end of the day, there's a designation announced. Now it will have to actually show analyses where systemic risks arise.
Like on a math test, the government will have to show its work. James Barth at Auburn University sees this as a healthy approach.
We regulate firms in such a way that we promote safe and sound financial activities, but we also don't want to impose excessive regulatory costs.
And if this decision helps push regulators away from focusing so much on size, more on the types of risk a company takes, that'd be a good thing, says Karen Petro. She's the managing partner of Federal Financial Analytics.
They're not all big, but when they're doing the same thing, particularly in risky ways, I think the rules should be the same.
I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
GE shares basically flat today. MetLife down about 1.5%. Otherwise, basically even Steven on Wall Street. On this Thursday, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's not often we bring you news of Argentinian legislative maneuvers, but today is your lucky day. The Senate there has okayed a deal to repay a couple of American hedge funds the $5 billion in government debt they are owed from the 2001 Argentinian default, a default that set that country on the economic road it's on right now, which is to say, lousy. The country's newish president, businessman Mauricio Macri, has been driving the deal, which he says will reassure international investors and, more significantly, let Argentina back into the global credit markets. Daniel Gallus is the BBC's South America business correspondent. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hello.
It has been 10 years, basically, more than 10 years, that Argentina has refused to pay these, what former President Kirchner said were vulture debts. Vulture funds, rather. What has changed?
Well, basically, Argentina went through a long ride since 2001. It went through some very good economic times, some very bad economic times more recently. During that period, it restructured about 93% of that debt, but 7% of the debt was not restructured. That's the so-called holdout funds. That's the people that did not accept a deal with the Argentinian government. Part of those funds, they are actually called vulture funds because it's a special business where you buy very cheap junk bonds in the market, and instead of getting them, trading them again, you go to the courts and you demand that money to be paid. So that is the payment that is now about to be made.
And the funds won in court, and now the Senate in Argentina has agreed to pay the debts. What will now be able to happen with the Argentinian economy that could not happen until today?
Well, Argentina has been struggling, basically just raising money internally, and it doesn't raise any money externally. So Argentina may be about to come back to international markets and raise about $12 billion. Mm. It needs that money desperately because inflation is running high and the government is just printing money in order to pay its debts.
When you go to Argentina and you walk up and down the streets in Buenos Aires or wherever, what does it feel like down there?
Well, Argentina is a strange country in many ways because it used to be a very wealthy, rich country. But since 2001, the crisis that they had and the devaluation and the debt problems that they had, Argentina has become a lot more poor since then. We see a lot of poverty in the streets of Argentina that we didn't see back a few years ago. The economy is quite difficult to navigate through. It was a very complicated place to do business. And I think this is what Mauricio Macri wants to bring to Argentina, which is sort of a more solid business environment.
This deal then is not the the end of all of the troubles, but it is perhaps the beginning of a fix, yeah?
Yeah, Argentina is very far from ending all its troubles because to begin with, Argentina doesn't even know what inflation it has because no one trusts their numbers. So they're trying to fix the economic bureau that comes up with those numbers that some people said that the past government just made a mess of that. They have to get the prices down in the economy. They have to get consumers back spending. They have to get international investors back in. It's all part of the process that we see happening with Mauricio Macri, but there is still a long way to go.
Daniel Gallus is the BBC South America business correspondent. We got him in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Daniel, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
As Elon Musk takes the wraps off Tesla's newest electric car tonight, the $30,000 or so dollar Tesla Model 3, a lot of the attention in the future of automobiles space is on self-driving cars. Autonomous vehicles, as they are sometimes called, are being tested in 17 states, but there is a glitch, and not under the hood either. It seems, as Marketplace's Sally Herships reports, that self-driving cars are only as smart as the roads they are driving on.
In some ways, people are still smarter than machines, like when it comes to recognizing a pothole might be coming up on a bumpy stretch of road.
Humans often have sort of an intuitive sense as to where road damage might be.
Ed Kim is with Auto Pacific, a market research firm. But he says self-driving cars, that's a skill they're still working on. Then there's that whole knowing how to stay in the lane thing. A lot of autonomous cars use sensors to read lines on the road.
In cities like New York City, lane markings can often be simply suggestions as opposed to, you know, actual defined markers that all cars follow.
Michael Pack is director of the University of Maryland Center for Advanced Transportation Technology.
I would love nothing more than to get in my car and be able to read the paper because I'm heading down to my job.
Pack says another hurdle is traffic, though maybe not the kind you're thinking of. Instead, it's internet traffic.
When you're driving 60 to 70 miles per hour down the interstate, you want to be absolutely sure that your vehicle is going to be able to communicate quickly and clearly with all the vehicles around it.
He says self-driving cars need to process their location, speed, and directions. That can use a lot of data. But here's where we take a sharp turn. Maybe it's the cars that need to get better, not us. Brad Templeton helped work on Google's driverless car.
It's the cars that are using simpler technology that haven't figured out how they can drive on what the real world has.
So maybe the future is here, almost. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, I'm a brewer, so to me, I always want another beer.
Oh, it's not just brewers, yo. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 31 points today, about a 10%, closed at 17,685. The S&P 500 gave back 4 points, 0.2%, 2,059. NASDAQ basically flat up 4 points, finished at 4,869. For the quarter, and it was a stormy one, if you remember right, the Dow up actually 1.4%. The S&P 500 advanced 0.7% since January the 1st, but the NASDAQ down 2% the past 3 months. After outbidding Marriott more than once to take over Starwood Hotels, China's Anbang Insurance Group is reported to be bailing on that deal. Starwood shareholders are going to be bummed. The stock took a 5% hit after the bell. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.77%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Public colleges and universities in the state of Texas are getting ready for a new reality come August the 1st. Students, faculty, and anybody else with a license to carry a concealed handgun will be able to bring their weapons into most buildings on campus. Texas is the 8th state to explicitly allow what's come to be called campus carry. There is a similar bill pending in Georgia. But the Texas law has already led to the departure of 2 prominent professors, and there are worries it could make it harder to recruit both faculty and students. From the Education Desk at WYPR Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story.
Law professor Stephen Good had the unenviable task of helping the University of Texas comply with the state's new gun law as chair of a campus carry working group. It's a law he dislikes so much, he's still hoping it will be repealed.
Sometimes you have not the best situation that you want, and you have to do the best you can with it.
The law gives university presidents leeway to create reasonable rules for their own campuses. Good's group worked for months to come up with recommendations on how handguns should be stored and carried and where they should be off limits. Ultimately, UT decided to ban guns at sporting events and health centers and in dorm rooms, but not in classrooms, because Good says that would have effectively flouted the law.
We were asked to try to come up with the best possible set of recommendations to implement a law that has been passed, and that's what we tried to do.
Against some pretty stiff opposition, students and faculty have held protests. More than 1,700 professors signed a petition opposing guns in the classroom.
I just didn't think that was appropriate to have firearms, concealed or not, in classrooms and other learning environments.
Fritz Steiner is dean of the School of Architecture, but not for much longer. He's leaving for a new post at the University of Pennsylvania, partly because of the new gun law.
Anyone who's ever taken an examination or defended a thesis or a dissertation knows those are stressful situations. And I don't think that having a firearm present in a very emotional interchange is a good idea.
At the University of Houston, the head of the faculty senate recently advised fellow professors to limit their office hours, be careful discussing sensitive topics, and not, quote, go there if they sensed anger. A slide from the presentation ended up on Twitter. Pharmacology professor Andrea Gore is chair of the faculty council at UT Austin, which represents more than 3,000 professors. She doesn't plan to change the way she teaches anatomy and physiology.
But I have heard from my colleagues that some of them are going to be much more cautious about taking more provocative points of view.
Gore also worries that some of the state's best and brightest students might opt for private colleges, which are exempt from the law, or go out of state.
When you hear from students or you hear from their parents, which I have, that they're not going to go to a public university anymore in the state of Texas, that translates into many people who are never going to come back to Texas because they establish roots somewhere else.
Students I talked to on the UT campus weren't all that worked up about the issue. Junior Leah Van grew up around guns in Fort Worth and says she's planning to own one someday.
I feel like I'm okay with it. I think, you know, it's the right to bear arms. We have a right to, you know, protect ourselves. And then a lot of people probably carry guns illegally anyway, and I probably don't even notice. So I think it's not going to make that much of a difference.
I talked to Van as she was eating lunch just steps away from UT's clock tower, where in 1966, an engineering student shot and killed 14 people. Since then, shootings on college campuses have become so frequent, Van says she'd feel safer if some of her fellow students were armed. But her friend, junior Dory Kay, sees that risk as a good reason to restrict guns.
What if there is somebody on campus who, you know, wants to use that gun for harmful purposes? If I had to, you know, choose a side, I wouldn't want guns on campus.
In Texas, people with concealed carry licenses are actually much less likely to commit crimes than the general population. On the more than 150 campuses around the country that allow guns, there have been a handful of accidental shootings, including one by a professor at Idaho State who shot himself in the foot during class. Even those who oppose the law concede its day-to-day impact could be minimal. Law professor Stephen Good says more than half of UT's 50,000 students are under 21 and too young to qualify.
We're talking about somewhere between 0.5% and 1% of our students we anticipate will have licenses. That doesn't mean they'll all carry their handguns on campus.
Still, as he looks out into his classroom next fall, he says he won't help but wonder, who's packing? In Austin, Texas, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I am a beer drinker. A snooty craft beer drinker, to be completely transparent here. But if you know anything about the beer industry today, you know it's mostly big. Anheuser-Busch InBev, SAB Miller, Heineken's like third or something. You get the point. It's an industry of big, giant conglomerates. And yet there are still some well-known, not ginormous breweries, bigger than the local ones that are opening up everywhere, but still small enough to be considered craft beer. That gets me to today's edition of Conversations from the Corner Office. Jim Cook, founder and CEO of the Boston Beer Company, known best for its flagship beverage, Samuel Adams Boston Lager.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
In between brewing 4 million barrels of beer last year and bringing in nearly $1 billion in revenue, Jim Cook found time to write a book, perhaps fittingly titled Quench Your Own Thirst, Business Lessons Learned Over a Beer or Two. Mr. Cook, thanks for coming on.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
What is it about beer for you that does it? I mean, it goes back a long way in your family. I get that. But why build your business on it?
Well, as you said, I'm the sixth oldest son in a row in my family to be a brewer. So beer is, it's kind of in my blood, about 0.06. So, you know, I'm legal.
So legal.
But it's always been a part of my life. And Ben Franklin, a drinking buddy of Samuel Adams, who said, beer is the best proof we have that God loves us and wants us to be happy.
You've been around for 30 plus or minus years now. The flagship Sam Adams Boston Lager Is it the same beer today as it was when you were burning it down in your basement?
It's actually better because...
says the salesman.
Well, when I started, I was very small. When I went to go select hops in Germany, I didn't really get to choose first because I was very small. I only needed a little bit of them. Now we are the largest user, purchaser, brewer of the noble hops that Bavaria produces. And now I pick first. You know, we get the best hops. And we've actually changed the growing practices in Bavaria to increase the aromatic components that I want.
You know, on that hops thing and how there have been all these stories the past 18 months or so about how there are so many IPAs now and everybody wants IPAs and, oh my goodness, you got to have big hoppy beers, of which I will confess I am a fan. Is there a craft beer bubble, do you think?
Well, I'm a brewer, so to me, I always want another beer. In fact, yeah. You know, is it okay if I
don't
do this sober? I mean, I don't think there's broadcasting under the influence. But as you say, let's do the numbers.
Touché.
When I started Sam Adams, there were about 50 breweries, and very few of us survived. I think there's only two of us, Sam Adams and Sierra Nevada. But today, there are over 4,000 breweries in the United States, and I think that 4,000 can continue to grow. I think we can have 10,000 breweries here in the United States.
You are, as you said, big. You are the biggest craft brewer in this country. You're like number five or something overall in breweries. Are you too big?
To me, you know, I'm proud of our success, but just to put it in perspective, we have 1% of the U.S. beer market. So we are the leading craft brewer, but all 4,000 craft brewers together have a little more than 10% of the market. And Sam Adams is in this unique position of being, you know, big enough to be able to do a lot of cool things and small enough to want to do the cool things.
I mean, I get that you guys like to think of yourselves as a small, happy band of which you are arguably first among equals. But let it escape nobody's notice that this is a cutthroat business.
You know, I think that's a misconception.
No, come on. If you were losing money, you wouldn't be around.
Well, of course, because, you know, it's like your show. If nobody listens to it, it's not going to be there.
Thank you for reminding me, yes.
For Sam Adams, it would probably surprise you if I told you that in 2008, there was a huge hop shortage. A lot of craft brewers couldn't get the hops that they needed to, you know, open their doors or to stay in business. So we shared our hops with hundreds of craft brewers who couldn't otherwise get hops.
Right. So listen, I get that this is probably a touchy question given that you're running a publicly traded company and all, but you are 65-something years old. You're not going to do this forever. What happens to Boston Beer when Jim Koch's not around anymore?
Well, I have a really good succession plan. And it's so good. It's worked every single day for 32 years. I'm going to tell you the secret. My succession plan is don't die. And for 32 years, I've gotten up every morning, and it's worked. So far, so good. And brewers tend to be fairly long-lived. So we'll see. And I've got 4 kids.
Oh, well, there you go. Jim Koch, you've surely had his beer, maybe one, maybe more. He's the founder, and he runs the Boston Beer Company. His new book is called Quench Your Own Thirst, Business Lessons Learned Over a Beer or Two. Mr. Koch, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Well, this has been a great pleasure. Cheers.
We've got an excerpt of Jim Koch's book on our website. That is marketplace.org, of course. Also, all the rest of our conversations from the Corner Office can be heard on our Corner Office podcast, available wherever you choose to do your downloads. This final note on the way out today, in which Missouri State Representative Tracy McCreary becomes my own personal hero. I read today in the Washington Post that Representative McCreary has offered up Missouri House Resolution 1220, which reads in full, whereas, on occasion, members of the Missouri House of Representatives have used the word physical instead of fiscal when referring to fiscal matters, including but not limited to Fiscal Review and Fiscal Notes, and whereas the use of proper terminology is important to our legislative process, now therefore be it resolved that we hereby urge members of the Missouri House of Representatives to use the word fiscal instead of physical when referring to fiscal matters. Come on, how great is that? All right, that is all we've got. The Dow off 31 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ flat-ish, really, up just 4 points. The S&P 500 gave back 4 points, 0.2%. Golda Arthur, John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Fiscal, you guys, not physical, okay?
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.